inspiration. Thomas Bowden Brooks chanced to draw from his bookcase an inexpensive, poorly sewn volume of philosophy bought at a used bookstand years before. He began to read, and was immediately soothed. He marveled at how, as Mann put it, a mastermind could lay hold of this cruel, mocking thing called life. This extraordinary clarity of vision and the volume of philosophy enthralled the dying man, and hours passed without his looking up from his reading. Then he came upon a chapter titled On Death and Its Relation to Our Personal Immortality, and, intoxicated by the words, read on as though he were reading for his very life. When he finished, Thomas Bowden Brooks was a man transformed, a man who had found the comfort and peace that had eluded him. What was it that the dying man discovered? At this point, Philip suddenly adopted an oracular voice. Now listen well, Julius Hertzfeld, because this may be useful for life's final examination. Shocked at being directly addressed in a public lecture, Julius bolted upright in his seat. He glanced nervously about him and saw, to his astonishment, that the auditorium was empty. Everyone, even the two homeless men, had left. But Philip, unperturbed by his vanished audience, calmly continued, I'll read a passage from Bowden Brooks. He opened a tattered paperback copy of the book. Your assignment is to read the novel, especially part 9, with great care. It will prove invaluable to you. Far more valuable than attempting to extract meaning from patient's reminiscences of long ago. Have I hope to live on in my son? In a personality yet more feeble, flickering, and timorous than my own? Blind, childish folly! What can my son do for me? Where shall I be when I am dead? Ah, it is so brilliantly clear. I shall be in all those who have ever, do ever, or ever shall say, I. Especially, however, in all those who say it most fully, potently, and gladly. Have I ever hated life? Pure, strong, relentless life? Folly and misconception. I have but hated myself because I could not bear it. I love you all, you blessed, and soon, soon I shall cease to be cut off from you by all the narrow bonds of myself. Soon that in me which loves you will be free and be in and with you. In and with you all. Philip closed the novel and returned to his notes. Now who was the author of the volume which so transformed Thomas Bowden Brooks? Mann does not reveal his name in the novel, but 40 years later, he wrote a magnificent essay which stated that Arthur Schopenhauer was the author of the volume. Mann then proceeds to describe how, at the age of 23, he first experienced the great joy of reading Schopenhauer. He was not only entranced by the ring of Schopenhauer's words, which he describes as so perfectly consistently clear, so rounded, its presentation and language so powerful, so elegant, so unerringly apposite, so passionately brilliant, so magnificently and blithely severe, like never any other in the history of German philosophy. But by the essence of Schopenhauerian thought, which he describes as emotional, breathtaking, playing between violent contrasts, between instinct and mind, passion and redemption. Then and there man resolved that discovering Schopenhauer was too precious an experience to keep to himself, and straightaway used it creatively by offering the philosopher to his suffering hero. And not only Thomas Mann, but many other great minds acknowledged their debt to Arthur Schopenhauer. Tolstoy called Schopenhauer the genius par excellence among men. To Richard Wagner, he was a gift from heaven. Nietzsche said that his life was never the same after purchasing a tattered volume of Schopenhauer in a used bookstore in Leipzig, and, as he put it, letting that dynamic, dismal genius work on my mind. Schopenhauer forever changed the intellectual map of the Western world, and without him, we would have had a very different and weaker Freud, Nietzsche, Hardy, Wittgenstein, Beckett, Ibsen, Conrad. Philip pulled out a pocket watch, studied it for a moment, and then, with great solemnity, "Here concludes my introduction to Schopenhauer. His philosophy has such breadth and depth, it defies a short summary. Hence I have chosen to pique your curiosity in the hope that you will read the 60-page chapter in your text carefully. I prefer to devote the last 20 minutes of this lecture to audience questions and discussion." "Are there questions from the audience, Dr. Hertzfeld?" Unnerved by Philip's tone, Julius once again scanned the empty auditorium and then softly said, "Philip, I wonder if you're aware that your audience has departed." "What audience? Them? Those so-called students?" Philip flicked his wrist in a disparaging manner to convey that they were beneath his notice, and neither their arrival nor their departure made the slightest difference to him. "You, Dr. Hertzfeld, are my audience today. I intended my lecture for you alone," said Philip, who in no way seemed discomfited by holding a conversation with someone 30 feet away in a cavernous, deserted auditorium. "All right, I'll bite. Why am I your audience today? Think about it, Dr. Hertzfeld. I'd prefer you'd call me Julius. If I refer to you as Philip, and I'm assuming that's okay with you, then it's only right that you call me Julius. Ah, deja vu all over again. How clearly I recall saying so very long ago. Call me Julius, please. We're not strangers." "I am not on a first-name basis with my clients because I am their professional consultant, not their friend. But as you wish, Julius it is. I'll start again. You inquire why you alone are my intended audience. My answer is that I am merely responding to your request for help. Think about it, Julius. You came to see me with a request for an interview, and embedded in that request were other requests." "Oh? Yes. Let me expand upon this matter. First, there was a tone of urgency in your voice. It was particularly important to you that I meet with you. Obviously, your request did not arise from simple curiosity about how I was doing. No, you wanted something else. You mentioned that your health was imperiled, and in a 65-year-old man, that means you must be confronting your death. Hence, I could only assume that you were frightened and searching for some kind of consolation. My lecture today is my response to your request." "An oblique response, Philip." "No more oblique than your request, Julius." "Touché. But as I recall, you've never minded obliquity. And I'm comfortable with it now. You made a request for help, and I responded by introducing you to the man who, of all men, can be most helpful to you." "And so your intent was to offer me solace by describing how man's dying Buddenbrooks received comfort from Schopenhauer?" "Precisely. And I offered that to you as only an appetizer, a sampler of what is to come. There is a great deal that I, as your guide to Schopenhauer can offer you, and I would like to make a proposal.
A proposal?
Philip, you continue to surprise. My curiosity is piqued. I've completed my coursework in a counseling program and all other requirements to obtain a state counseling license, except that I need 200 more hours of professional supervision. I can continue practicing as a clinical philosopher. That field is not regulated by the state. But a counselor's license would offer me a number of advantages, including the ability to buy malpractice insurance and to market myself more effectively. Unlike Schopenhauer, I have neither an independent source of financial support nor any secure academic support. You've seen with your own eyes the disinterest in philosophy displayed by the clods who attend this pigsty of a university. Philip, why must we shout to one another? The lecture is over. Would you mind taking a seat and continuing this discussion more informally?
Of course.
Philip collected his lecture notes, stuffed them into his briefcase, and eased into a seat in the front row. Though they were closer, four rows of seats still separated them, and Philip was forced to swivel his neck awkwardly to see Julius.
So am I correct in assuming that you propose a swap? I supervise you, and you teach me about Schopenhauer?
Julius now asked in a low voice.
Right.
Philip turned his head, but not enough to make eye contact.
And you've given thought to the precise mechanics of our arrangement?
I've given much thought to it. In fact, Dr. Hertzfeld,
Julius.
Yes, yes, Julius. What I was going to say is that I'd been considering the idea of calling you for several weeks to try to arrange supervision, but kept putting it off. Primarily for financial reasons. So I was startled by the remarkable coincidence of your call.
As for mechanics, I suggest meeting weekly and splitting our hour. Half the time you provide expert advice about my patients, and half the time I am your guide to Schopenhauer.
Julius closed his eyes and lapsed into thought. Philip waited 2 or 3 minutes and then...
What say you to my offer?
Even though I'm certain no students will appear, I'm scheduled for office hours after my lecture, and so must head back to the administration building.
Well, Philip, it's not your everyday offer. I need more time to think it through. Let's meet later this week. I take off Wednesday afternoons. Can you do 4 o'clock?
Philip nodded.
I finish at 3 on Wednesday. Shall we meet in my office?
No, Philip.
My office.
It's in my home at 249 Pacific Avenue, not too far from my old office.
Here, take my card.
Excerpts from Julius's journal. After his lecture, Philip's proposal for a supervision tutoring swap stunned me. How quickly one moves back into the familiar force field of another person. So much like the state-dependent memories and dreams, in which the landscape's eerie familiarity reminds you that you've visited the identical locale before in other dreams. Same with marijuana. Couple of hits and suddenly you're in a familiar place thinking familiar thoughts that exists only in the marijuana state. And it's the same with Philip. Only a little time in his presence and, presto, my deep memories of him plus a peculiar Philip-induced state of mind reappear in a flash. How arrogant, how disdainful he is, how uncaring about others. And yet there is something strong, I wonder what, that draws me to him. His intelligence? His loftiness and otherworldliness coupled to such extraordinary naivete? And how unchanged he is after 22 years. No, that's not true. He's liberated from the sexual compulsion,
no longer doomed to walk nose to ground forever sniffing for pussy. He lives much more in the higher places he's always longed for. But his manipulativeness, that's still there. And so patent. And he's so clueless about its visibility. About how I should leap at his offer. How I should give him 200 hours of my time in return for him teaching me Schopenhauer. And brazenly presenting it as though it was I who suggested it. Who want and need it. Can't deny that I have some slight interest in Schopenhauer. But spending a couple 100 hours with Philip to learn about Schopenhauer right now is low on my wish list. And if that excerpt he read about the dying Buddenbrooks is a prime example of what Schopenhauer has to offer me, then it leaves me cold. The idea of rejoining the universal openness without any persistence of me and my memories and unique consciousness is the coldest of comfort. No, it's no comfort at all. And what draws Philip to me? That's another question. That crack the other day about the $20,000 he wasted on his therapy with me? Maybe he is still looking for some return on his investment. Supervise Philip? Make him a legitimate kosher therapist? There's a dilemma. Do I want to sponsor him? Do I want to give him my blessing when I don't believe that a hater, and he is a hater, can help anyone grow? 8. Religion has everything on its side. Revelation, prophecies, government protection, the highest dignity and eminence, and more than this, the invaluable prerogative of being allowed to imprint its doctrines on the mind at a tender age of childhood, whereby they become almost innate ideas. Halcyon days of early childhood. Johanna wrote in her diary that after Arthur's birth in February 1788, she, like all young mothers, enjoyed playing with her new doll. But new dolls soon become old dolls, and within months Johanna wearied of her toy and languished in boredom and isolation in Danzig. Something new was emerging in Johanna. Some vague sense that motherhood was not her true destiny, that some other future awaited her. Her summers at the Schopenhauer country estate were particularly difficult. Though Heinrich, accompanied by a clergyman, joined her for weekends, Johanna spent the rest of the time alone with Arthur and her servants. Because of his fierce jealousy, Heinrich forbade his wife to entertain neighbors or to venture from home for any reason. When Arthur was 5, the family encountered great stress. Prussia annexed Danzig, and shortly before the advancing Prussian troops arrived under the command of the very general Heinrich had insulted years before, the entire Schopenhauer family fled to Hamburg. There, in 1797, in a strange city, Johanna gave birth to her second child, Adele, and felt ever more trapped and despairing. Heinrich, Johanna, Arthur, Adele, father, mother, son, daughter, the four bound together yet unconnected. To Heinrich, Arthur was a chrysalis destined to emerge as the future head of the Schopenhauer mercantile house. Heinrich was the traditional Schopenhauer father. He attended to business and put his son out of mind, intending to spring into action and assume fatherly duties when Arthur had finished his childhood. And the wife? What was Heinrich's plan for her? She was the Schopenhauer family seed pod and cradle. Dangerously vital, she had to be contained, protected, and restrained. And Johanna? What did she feel? Trapped. Her husband and provider, Heinrich, was her lethal mistake, her joyless jailer, the grim evacuator of her vitality. And her son, Arthur? Was he not part of the trap, the seal to her coffin? A talented woman, Johanna had a desire for expression and self-realization that was growing at a ferocious pace, and Arthur would prove a woefully inadequate recompense for self-renunciation. And her young daughter? Little noticed by Heinrich. Adele was assigned a minor role in the family drama and was destined to spend her entire life as Johanna Schopenhauer's amanuensis. And so the Schopenhauers each went their separate ways. Father Schopenhauer, heavy with anxiety and despair, lumbered to his death 16 years after Arthur's birth by climbing to the upper freight window of the Schopenhauer warehouse and leaping into the frigid waters of the Hamburg Canal. Mother Schopenhauer, sprung from her matrimonial trap by Heinrich's leap, kicked the grime of Hamburg from her shoes and flew like the wind to Weimar, where she quickly created one of Germany's liveliest literary salons. There she became the dear friend of Goethe and other outstanding men of letters, and authored a dozen best-selling romantic novels, many about women who were forced into unwanted marriages but refused to bear children and continued to long for love. And young Arthur? Arthur Schopenhauer was to grow up into one of the wisest men who ever lived, and one of the most despairing and life-hating of men, a man who at the age of 55 would write, "Could we foresee it? There are times when children might seem like innocent prisoners condemned not to death but to life, and as yet all too unconscious of what their sentence means. Nevertheless, every man desires to reach old age, a state of life of which it may be said, it is bad today, and every day it will get worse, until the worst of all happens." 9. In endless space, countless luminous spheres, round each of which some dozen smaller illuminated ones revolve, hot at the core and covered with a cold, hard crust, on which a moldy film has produced living and knowing beings. This is the real, the world. Julius's spacious Pacific Heights home was far grander than any he could now possibly afford to buy. He was one of the lucky millionaires in San Francisco who had the good fortune to buy a house, any house, 30 years earlier. It was his wife Miriam's $30,000 inheritance money that had made the purchase possible, and, unlike any other investment Julius and Miriam had ever made, the house's value had rocketed upward. After Miriam's death, Julius considered selling the house. It was far too large for one person. But instead, he moved his office into the first floor of the house. 4 steps led from the street to a landing with a blue-tiled fountain. On the left, a few stairs led to Julius's office. On the right was a longer stairway to his home. Philip arrived precisely on time. Julius greeted him at the door, escorted him into the office, and gestured toward an auburn leather chair. "Some coffee or tea?" But Philip did not look around as he took his seat and, ignoring Julius's offer, said, "I await your decision about supervision." "Ah, once again, straight to the business at hand. I'm having a difficult time with that decision. Lots of questions. There's something about your request, a deep contradiction, that puzzles the hell out of me. Undoubtedly, you want to know why I'm asking you for supervision after being so dissatisfied with you as a therapist?" "Precisely. In exceedingly clear language, you claim that our therapy was a colossal failure, a waste of 3 years and a great deal of your money." "There's no true contradiction," Philip replied instantaneously. One can be a competent therapist and supervisor even though one fails with a particular patient. Research shows that therapy, in any hands, is unsuccessful for about a third of patients. Besides, there's no doubt I played a significant role in the failure. My stubbornness, my rigidity. Your only error was to choose the wrong type of therapy for me, and then persist in it far too long. However, I'm not incognizant of your effort, even your interest in helping me. Sounds good, Philip. Sounds logical. But still, to ask for supervision from a therapist who gave you nothing in therapy. Damned if I'd do it. I'd find someone else. I have a feeling that there's something more. Something you're not saying. Perhaps a modest retraction is in order. It is not entirely accurate to say I got nothing from you. You did make two statements that stuck with me, and may have played some instrumental role in my recovery. For a moment, Julius fumed about having to ask for details. Did Philip think he wouldn't be interested? Could he be that much of a space cadet? Finally, he gave in and said, "And which two statements?" Well, the first statement doesn't sound like much, but it had some power. I had been telling you about one of my typical evenings, you know, picking up a woman somewhere, taking her to dinner, the seduction scene in my bedroom with the same routine and the same mood music. I remember asking your opinion of my evening and whether you found it distasteful or immoral. I don't remember my answer. You said you found it neither distasteful nor immoral, only boring. It jolted me to think I was living a boring, repetitious life. Ah, interesting. So, that was one statement. The other? We were discussing tombstone epitaphs. I don't remember why. But I believe you had raised the question of what epitaph I might select for myself. Very possible. I've used that question when I feel at an impasse and need some shocking intervention. And? Well, you suggested that I might have my tombstone engraved with the phrase, "He liked to fuck." And then you added that the phrase could be a good epitaph for my dog, too. That I could use the same stone for both me and the dog. Pretty strong stuff. Was I really that harsh? Whether it is harsh or not is irrelevant. What's important is the effectiveness and persistence. Much later, maybe 10 years later, I made use of it. Time-delayed interventions. I've always had a hunch they're more important than usually thought. Always meant to do a study of that. But for our purposes today, tell me, why were you reluctant at our last meeting to mention these? To acknowledge that I had in some way, even some small way, been useful to you? Julius, I'm not sure I see the relevance of this to the issue at hand. That is, whether you are or are not willing to be my psychotherapy supervisor, and to permit me in return to be your Schopenhauerian advisor. The fact that you don't see the relevance makes it all the more relevant. Philip, I'm not going to attempt to be diplomatic. Here it is straight. I'm not certain you're basically equipped to be a therapist, and hence I have some doubts that supervision makes sense. You say, not equipped. Clarify, please. Said Philip with no trace of discomfort. Well, let me put it this way. I've always regarded therapy more as a calling than a profession, a way of life for people who care about others. I don't see sufficient caring in you. The good therapist wants to alleviate suffering, wants to help people grow. But I see in you only disdain for others. Look at the way you dismissed and insulted your students. Therapists need to relate to their patients, whereas you care little about how others feel. Take the two of us. You tell me that, on the basis of my phone call to you, you made the assumption that I had a fatal illness. Yet never did you utter a word of consolation or sympathy. Would that have helped? Mumbling some vacuous words of sympathy? I gave you more, much more. I constructed and delivered an entire lecture for you. I understand that now, but it was all so oblique, Philip. It made me feel like I was being managed, not cared about. Better for me, much better, if you had been direct. If you had sent some message from your heart to mine, nothing monumental, maybe just some simple inquiry into my situation or state of mind, or, Christ, you might have simply said, I'm sorry to hear you're dying. How hard would that have been? If I were sick, that's not what I'd want. I would have wanted the tools, the ideas, the vision that Schopenhauer offered in the face of death. And that's what I delivered to you. Even now, Philip, you still don't bother to check your assumption that I have a fatal illness. Am I mistaken? Come again, Philip. Say the words. It won't hurt. You said you had significant health problems. Can you tell me more? Good start, Philip. An open-ended comment is by far the best choice. Julius paused to collect his thoughts and to consider how much to reveal to Philip. Well, I've very recently learned that I have a form of skin cancer called malignant melanoma, which poses a serious threat to my life. Though my doctors assure me that for the next year I should remain in good health. I feel even more strongly, Philip responded, that the Schopenhauerian vision I offered in my lecture would be of value to you. In our therapy, I remember you once said that life was a temporary condition with a permanent solution. That is pure Schopenhauer. Philip, that perspective was meant in jest. Well, we know, don't we, what your own guru, Sigmund Freud, had to say about jesting. My point still stands. Schopenhauer's wisdom contains much that will serve you well. I'm not your supervisor, Philip. That's still to be determined, but I'll give you psychotherapy lesson number one, gratis. It's not ideas, nor vision, nor tools that truly matter in therapy. If you debrief patients at the end of therapy about the process, what do they remember? Never the ideas. It's always the relationship. They rarely remember an important insight their therapist offered, but generally fondly recall their personal relationship with the therapist. And I'm going to venture a guess that this is even true for you. Why did you remember me so well and value what happened between us so much that you now, after all these years, turn to me for supervision? It's not because of those two comments, however provocative they were. No, I believe it was because of some bond you felt with me. I believe you might have some deep affection for me. And because our relationship, however difficult though it might have been, was meaningful, you are now turning to me again in the hope of some form of embrace. Wrong on all counts, Dr. Hertzfeld. Yeah. Yes, so wrong that the mere mention of an embrace sends you scurrying back to formal titles again. Wrong on all counts, Julius. First, I want to caution you against the error of assuming that your view of reality is the real thing, the res naturalis, and that your mission is to impose this vision on others. You crave and value relationships, and you make the erroneous assumption that I, indeed, everyone must do the same, and that if I claim otherwise, I have repressed my relationship craving. It seems likely, Philip continued, that a philosophical approach may be far preferable for someone like me. The truth is, you and I are fundamentally different. I have never drawn pleasure from the company of others. Their drivel, their demands, their ephemeral, petty strivings, their pointless lives are a nuisance and an obstacle to my communion with the handful of great world spirits who have something of significance to say. Then why sign on to be a therapist? Why not remain with the great world spirits? Why busy yourself offering help to these pointless lives? If, like Schopenhauer, I had an inheritance to support myself, I assure you I would not be here today. It's entirely a matter of economic need. My educational expenses have depleted my bank account. My teaching pays a pittance. The college is near bankruptcy. And I doubt that I will be rehired. I need to see only a few clients a week to meet my expenses. I live frugally. I wish to acquire nothing except the freedom to pursue what is truly important to me. My reading, thinking, meditation, music, chess, and my walks with Rugby, my dog. You have still not answered my question. Why come to see me when it is clear I work in quite a different fashion from the way you want to work? And you haven't responded to my conjecture that there's something about our past relationship drawing you to me. I didn't respond because it's so far off the mark. But since it seems important to you, I'll continue to ponder your conjecture. Don't conclude that I'm questioning the presence of basic interpersonal needs. Schopenhauer himself said that bipeds, his term, need to huddle together by the fire for warmth. He cautioned, however, about getting singed by too much huddling. He liked porcupines. They huddled for warmth, but used their quills to keep their separateness. He treasured his separateness and depended on nothing outside himself for his happiness. And he wasn't alone on this. Other great men, Montaigne, for example, shared this way of thinking. I also fear bipeds, Philip continued. And I agree with his observation that a happy man is one who can avoid most of his fellow creatures. And how can you not agree that bipeds create a hell here on earth? Schopenhauer believed homo homini lupus. Man is a wolf to man. I'm certain that he was the inspiration for Sartre's No Exit. All well and good, Philip. But you're confirming my very point, that you may not be equipped to work as a therapist. Your point of view leaves no room for friendships. Every time I reach out to another, I end up with less of myself. I have not had a friendship in adulthood, nor do I care to form one. You may remember I was a solitary child with a disinterested mother and an unhappy father who eventually took his life. To be frank, I've never met anyone who has anything of interest to offer me. And it's not because I haven't looked. Every time I've tried to befriend someone, I've had the same experience as Schopenhauer, who said he only found miserable wretches, men of limited intelligence, bad heart, and mean disposition. I'm referring to living persons, not to the great thinkers of the past. You met me, Philip. That was a professional relationship. I refer to social encounters. These attitudes are visible in your behavior. With your contempt and lack of social skills spawned by this contempt, how can you possibly interact with others in a therapeutic manner? We're not in disagreement there. I agree I need to work on social skills. A little friendliness and warmth, Schopenhauer said, makes it possible to manipulate people just as we need to warm wax if we wish to work it. Julius rose, shaking his head. He poured a cup of coffee for himself and paced back and forth. Working wax is not just a bad metaphor. It's about the worst goddamn metaphor for therapy I've ever encountered. In fact, it is the worst. You sure as hell are not pulling your punches. Nor, incidentally, are you making your friend and therapist Arthur Schopenhauer endearing to me. Taking his seat again and sipping his coffee, Julius said, I'm not repeating my offer of coffee because I'm assuming you want nothing to do with anything except the answer to your singular question about supervision. You seem very strongly focused, Philip, so I will be merciful and cut to the chase. Here's my decision about supervising you. Philip, who had been averting his gaze throughout this discussion, looked directly at Julius for the first time. You've got a fine mind, Philip. You know a great deal. Maybe you'll find a way to harness your knowledge in the service of therapy. Maybe you'll end up making real contributions. I hope so. But you're not ready to be a therapist. And you're not ready for supervision. Your interpersonal skills, sensitivity, and awareness need work. A lot of work. But I want to be helpful to you. I failed once. And now I've got a second chance. Can you think of me as your ally, Philip? Let me answer that question after I hear your proposal, which I assume is imminent. Jesus. All right, here it is. I, Julius Hertzfeld, agree to be Philip Slate's supervisor if, and only if, he first spends 6 months as a patient in my psychotherapy group. For once, Philip was startled. He had not anticipated Julius's response. You're not serious. Never been more. I tell you that after so many years of sloshing about in the sewers, I finally got my life together. I tell you that I want to earn a living as a therapist, and that to do so I need a supervisor. That's the one thing I need. Instead, you offer me what I don't want and can't afford. I repeat, you're not ready for supervision, not ready to be a therapist. But I think that group therapy can begin to address your deficits. Those are my conditions. First, a course of group therapy, and then, and only then, will I supervise you. Your group therapy fees? Not high. $70 for a 90-minute session, and incidentally, that's billed even if you miss a meeting. How many patients in the group? I try to keep it about 7. 7 times $70. That's $490 for an hour and a half. That's an interesting commercial venture. And what's the point of group therapy, the way you do it? The point? What have we been talking about? Look, Philip, I'll be blunt. How can you be a therapist when you don't know what the fuck is going on between you and other people? No, I've gotten that point. My question was imprecise. I've had no training in group therapy and am asking for clarification about how it operates. How will it profit me to hear others describe their lives and problems en masse? The very idea of such a chorus of misery appalls me. Although, as Schopenhauer points out, there is always pleasure in learning that others suffer more than you. Oh, you're asking for an orientation. That's a justified request. I make a point of providing an orientation to group therapy to every patient entering a group. Every therapist should do that. So let me give you my spiel. First, my approach is rigorously interpersonal. and I make the assumption that each member is in the group because of difficulties in establishing sustaining relationships. But that's not true. I neither wish nor need... I know, just humor me on this, Philip. I merely said I make the assumption that these interpersonal difficulties are present. I assume it's the case whether you agree or not. As for my goal in the therapy group, I can be real clear about that. It is to help each member understand as much as possible about how he or she relates to each person in the group, including the therapist. I maintain a here and now focus. That's an essential concept for you to master as a therapist, Philip. In other words, the group works ahistorically. We focus on the now. There's no need to investigate each member's past history in depth. We focus on the current moment in the group. And on the here, forget about what members say has gone wrong in other relationships. I make the assumption that group members will manifest the same behavior in the group that has created difficulties for them in their social life. And I further assume that ultimately they will generalize what they learn about their group relationships to their relationships outside. Is that clear? I can give you reading material if you wish. It's clear. What ground rules does the group have? First, confidentiality. You speak to no one about other members of the group. Second, you strive to reveal yourself and to be honest in expressing your perceptions of other members and your feelings about them. Third, everything must go on inside the group. If there is contact between members outside the group, it must be brought back into the group and discussed. And this is the only way you're willing to supervise me? Absolutely. You want me to train you? Well, this is my prerequisite. Philip sat silently with eyes closed and his forehead resting on his clasped hands. Then he opened his eyes and said, I'll go along with your suggestion only if you are willing to credit the group therapy sessions as supervisory hours. That's a stretch, Philip. Can you imagine the ethical dilemma that creates for me? Can you imagine the dilemma your proposal creates for me? To turn my attention to my relations with others when I never wish for anyone to be anything to me. Besides, did you not imply that improving my social skills will make me more effective as a therapist? Julius stood up, took his coffee cup to the sink, shook his head, wondered about what he had gotten himself into, returned to his seat, exhaled slowly, and said, Fair enough. I'll agree to sign off the group therapy hours as supervision. One other thing. We haven't discussed the logistics of the exchange, of my offering you guidance on Schopenhauer. Whatever we do on that matter will have to wait, Philip. Another therapy pointer. Avoid dual relationships with patients. They will interfere with therapy. I refer to all kinds of ancillary relationships, romantic, business, even teacher and student. So I much prefer, and this is for your sake, to keep our relationship clean and clear. That's why I'm suggesting we start with the group and then, in the future, enter into a supervisory relationship and then... Possibly, I make no promises. A philosophy tutorial. Though at the moment I feel no great desire to study Schopenhauer. Still, can we establish a fee for my future philosophical consultation with you? That's iffy and a long way off, Philip. I'd still like to set the fee. You continue to amaze me, Philip. The goddamnest things you worry about. And the things you don't. Just the same, what's a fair fee? My policy is to charge the supervisee the same fee I charge for individual therapy, with some reduction for beginning students. Done, said Philip, nodding. Hold on, Philip. I want to be certain you've heard me say that the idea of a Schopenhauer tutorial arrangement is not of great import to me. When the topic first arose between us, all I did was to voice some slight interest in how Schopenhauer had provided so much help to you. And you ran with the ball and assumed we had made a contractual agreement. I hope to increase your interest in his work. He had much to say of great value to our field. In so many ways, he anticipated Freud, who borrowed his work wholesale without acknowledgement. I'll keep an open mind, but I repeat, many of the things you've said about Schopenhauer do not pique my desire to know more about his work. Including what I said in my lecture about his views on death? Especially that. The idea that one's essential being will ultimately be reunited with some vague, ethereal, universal life force offers me zero comfort. If there is no persistence of consciousness, what possible solace could I draw from that? By the same token, I get little comfort from knowing that my bodily molecules will be dispersed into space, and that ultimately my DNA will end up being a part of some other life form. I'd like us to read together his essays on death and on the indestructibility of being. If we did, I'm certain... Not now, Philip. At the moment, I'm not as much interested in death as I am in living the rest of my life as fully as possible. That's where I am. Death is always there, the horizon of all these concerns. Socrates said it most clearly. To learn to live well, one must first learn to die well. Or Seneca. No man enjoys the true taste of life but he who is willing and ready to quit it. Yes, yes, I know these homilies. And maybe in the abstract they are true. And I have no quarrel with incorporating the wisdom of philosophy into psychotherapy. I'm all for it. And I also know that Schopenhauer has served you well in many ways. But not in all ways. There's a possibility that you may need some remedial work. And that's where the group comes in. I look forward to seeing you here for your first meeting next Monday at 4:30. 10. Just because the terrible activity of the genital system still slumbers, while that of the brain already has its full briskness, childhood is the time of innocence and happiness, the paradise of life, the lost Eden, on which we look back longingly through the whole remaining course of our life. The happiest years of Arthur's life. When Arthur turned 9, his father decided the time had come to take over the direction of his son's education. His first step was to deposit him for 2 years in Le Havre at the home of a business partner, Grégoire de Blessamer. There, Arthur was to learn French, social graces, and, as Heinrich put it, become read in the books of the world. Expelled from home, separated from his parents at the age of 9, how many children have regarded such exile as a catastrophic life event? Yet, later in life, Arthur described these 2 years as, by far, the happiest part of his childhood. Something important happened in Le Havre. Perhaps for the only time in his life, Arthur felt nurtured and enjoyed life. For many years afterward, he cherished the memory of the convivial Bessamers, with whom he found something resembling paternal love. His letters to his parents were so full of praise for them that his mother felt compelled to remind him of his father's virtues and largesse. "Remember how your father permits you to buy that ivory flute for 1 louis d'or." Another important event took place during his sojourn in Le Havre. Arthur found a friend, one of the very few of his entire life. Enfim, the Blessamer's son, was the same age as Arthur. The two boys became close in Le Havre and exchanged a few letters after Arthur returned to Hamburg. Years later, as young men of 20, they met once again and on a few occasions went out together searching for amorous adventures. Then their paths and their interests diverged. Althea became a businessman and disappeared from Arthur's life until 30 years later when they had a brief correspondence, in which Arthur sought some financial advice. When Althea responded with an offer to manage his portfolio for a fee, Arthur abruptly ended the correspondence. By that time, he suspected everyone and trusted no one. He put Anthime's letter aside after jotting on the back of the envelope a cynical aphorism from Gracian, a Spanish philosopher much admired by his father. Make one's entry into another's affair in order to leave with one's own. Arthur and Anthime had one final meeting 10 years later, an awkward encounter during which they found little to say to one another. Arthur described his old friend as an unbearable old man, and wrote in his journal that the feeling of two friends meeting after a generation of absence will be of great disappointment with the whole of life. Another incident marked Arthur's stay in Le Havre. He was introduced to death. A childhood playmate in Hamburg, Gottfried Janisch, died while Arthur was living in Le Havre. Although Arthur seemed undemonstrative and said that he never again thought of Gottfried, it is apparent that he never truly forgot his dead playmate, nor the shock of his first acquaintance with mortality, because 30 years later he described a dream in his journal. I found myself in a country unknown to me. A group of men stood on a field, and among them a slim, tall, adult man who, I do not know how, had been made known to me as Gottfried Janisch, and he welcomed me. Arthur had little difficulty interpreting the dream. At that time, he was living in Berlin in the midst of a cholera epidemic. The dream image of a reunion with Gottfried could only mean one thing, a warning of approaching death. Consequently, Arthur decided to escape death by immediately leaving Berlin. He chose to move to Frankfurt, where he was to live the last 30 years of his life, largely because he thought it to be cholera-proof. 11. The greatest wisdom is to make the enjoyment of the present the supreme object of life, because that is the only reality, all else being the play of thought. But we could just as well call it our greatest folly, because that which exists only a moment and vanishes as a dream can never be worth a serious effort. Philip's first meeting. Philip arrived 15 minutes early for his first group therapy meeting, wearing the same clothes as in his two previous encounters with Julius. The wrinkled, faded checkered shirt, khaki pants, and corduroy jacket. Marveling at Philip's consistent indifference to clothes, office furnishings, his student audience, or, seemingly, anyone with whom he interacted, Julius once again began to question his decision to invite Philip into the group. Was it sound professional judgment? Or was his chutzpah raising its ugly head again? Chutzpah. Raw, nervy brashness. Chutzpah. Best defined by the renowned story of the boy who murdered his parents and then pleaded for mercy from the court on the grounds that he was an orphan. Chutzpah often entered Julius's mind when he reflected upon his approach to life. Perhaps he had been imbued with chutzpah from the start, but he first consciously embraced it in the autumn of his 15th year, when his family relocated from the Bronx to Washington, D.C., his father, who had had a financial setback, moved the family into a small row house on Farragut Street in Northwest Washington. The nature of his father's financial difficulties was off limits to any inquiry, but Julius was convinced that it had something to do with the aqueduct racetrack, and she's all that, a horse he owned with Vic Pacello, one of his poker cronies. Vic was an elusive figure who wore a pink handkerchief in his yellow sports jacket, and took care never to enter their home if his mother was present. His father's new job was managing a liquor store owned by a cousin felled at